Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. I'm Eli Mazur, and today we're lucky to be joined by John Herdy. He's someone who I wanted to have on this podcast from the beginning, and he's a managing partner of my firm. Along with his twin brother, Paul Herdy, John founded the firm almost 20 years ago, and the firm focuses on patent preparation and prosecution for large technology companies. So today we will be discussing innovation in the legal, in the patent legal field, and the story of the firm. Thank you so much for doing this, John.
I'm glad to be here.
So when I usually describe the firm to people in the IP field, the reaction is, well, that sounds different. So you heard me do a little introduction, you know, to something bland, like we prepare and prosecute patent applications. But how would you describe the firm, I guess, if in an elevator?
In an elevator pitch.
Yeah.
The way I probably would describe the firm, I mean, we operate the firm way different than traditional law firms. And so it's a patent firm that's run like a business and almost has a tech startup environment inside.
And we'll talk obviously a lot more about that, but innovation is a very popular buzzword that you hear right now, that you hear a lot in the legal field. When did you first start thinking about it as part of the what you're doing here at the firm?
So we started thinking about innovation at the beginning of 2013. And it was at the beginning of that year that I got a phone call from one of our clients that we've represented for a very long time. And the call was about fees and that fees were going down again. There was a trend from the beginning of the firm where fees had gone up, 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 leveled off maybe around 2006 to 2008. And then we started taking small steps down. And then this call at the beginning of 2013 was a bigger jump down. And it was at that time, at the beginning of that year, that we, as a firm, we had a meeting to talk about this wake-up call that we got. And really, this client was the first one who had decreased fees for us. So the others had really kind of leveled off. They weren't going up, but they had leveled off, and none of them had taken any dips down at this point. So at the beginning of 2013, we had a conversation in the firm about this wake-up call that we got from this client. And I had told the firm that we have a big decision to make here. So the decision is that we can decide to walk away from this client and future clients who are going to reduce fees and only represent those companies that are going to pay top dollar. But the problem is this. I predicted, and I think we all kind of knew this, anybody in the field kind of knew that this was only the beginning. This client was only the beginning. The Patent 300, the fees are going to be coming down over time. And the decision, there's going to be less and less companies that are going to be paying this top dollar, and every single firm is going to be fighting to represent those clients. And so the other way, the path that we voted and took was the path of efficiencies. And so what we did internally, we said, look, if we get more efficient at what we do, not only can we handle this price drop, we could handle additional price drops from this client and others. And really, now this opens up the world. We can represent anybody as long as we get efficient. And that started really a lot of the innovation here at the firm.
And we'll talk a lot about that innovation, but I guess something that I... Were you surprised by the timing? It seems 2013 was kind of after the recession. Do you know what kind of... Was it the change in the value of the patents? Were you personally surprised by how that kind of played out?
No, I'm not necessarily surprised. You know, from the early days of this firm and maybe even before we started this firm, you know, it was mostly the law firms that dictated the prices paid for patent work.
Yeah.
And so the patent 300 companies started to understand, like, now, wait a minute, why are we letting the law firms control what we do? We control the pricing. And so I wasn't really surprised that we were having these price drops. And, you know, they started understanding that we should control the process and not the law firms, and that the prices were too high. And the way that they were going in the early days for us, we were efficient in 1999.
Yeah.
and profitable with the work that we were doing. And the prices kept going up. And I'm like, it doesn't warrant these types of prices. It doesn't. And it looked like it was on pace that these patent applications for the big companies were going to end up being $20,000 or $30,000, which is outrageous to me.
Yeah.
And so, I wasn't surprised. Did I think it was going to happen in 2013? No. But I wasn't surprised that they finally woke up.
Yeah, that's interesting how that played out. I guess before we dive into the rest of the interview, I wanted to mention that we are hiring. So if somebody listens to this interview and strikes a chord with them, I guess, can you talk a little bit about the kind of people that we're looking for as a firm?
Yeah, so we're looking for A players. You have to really be outstanding at patent preparation and prosecution. And again, I mean, even support staff level, we're looking for A players. I can tell you, Eli, it's way different the way we hire today than it was back in the early days. Early days, we hired mostly on a pulse. If you came in and we would ask you a couple of questions, we would then pitch you on the firm, make you an offer as long as you had a pulse. And if you accepted, you were in the door. And you make, hiring decisions like that, and you make some really horrendous hiring decisions, which is what we did. Today, it is very difficult to get in. Less than 3% of people make it in. And you really need to be a superstar. So we're hiring superstars. And it's really important for us to have superstars to operate the way that we operate.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about you, about how you came to become the managing partner of this firm. Do you remember when you first heard about patents as a child or as a...
No, it definitely wasn't as a child. The first time it was when Paul started working at the patent office.
So your twin brother Paul
was working at the patent office. I was working for a defense contractor in Falls Church, Virginia. And he said, what a great gig this is at the patent office. Easy job. They're paying a lot. I get paid for overtime. And I had the opposite situation. And I'm like, wow, that sounds good. And so that was the first time I heard it. And that was probably, say, 1991, 92.
So what was your impression when you first started working at the USPTO?
Loved it. It was the easiest job that I ever had and ever. I was really good at it. I advanced as quickly as you possibly could advance. And I made it to primary. And the day that they told me I was a primary was the day that I gave notice and I left. I was in law school at the time and my intention was to move on, but I wanted to get that before I moved on.
So it sounds like it was the best job you ever had. Did you ever consider staying there forever or...
No, I didn't. I had many conversations with attorneys who came in to do interviews. We did a lot of in-person interviews back in that day. And I wanted to understand a lot of things about what they do and how much they get paid. And I compared it to what I was doing. And I'm like, well, if they can do it, I think I can do it. And they're making a lot more. So my intention was to go to law school. Now, if the patent office back then allowed you to work from home like they do today, wow, I don't know if I would have gone to law school and have this firm today. Yeah. I really don't know.
When you were looking for a firm, do you remember what that process was like? What was the IP market at the time? Was it, if you have a pulse, they'd hire you as well?
Basically, that was the way that it was, yeah. So I fully expected to go to Finnegan. That's really where I was going to go. I mean, Finnegan in the 90s was the firm. Every company that's handing out work, you give work to Finnegan. Every person who wants to work at a firm, you go to Finnegan. And the only reason I didn't go to Finnegan was because my twin brother Paul had gone to Finnegan. And I'm like, I can't follow him around my whole career. And so I went to a firm and a boutique in Alexandria. I had some friends that were working there, and it was just, to me, let's get out, let's get some experience, and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do.
And I guess, what was it like working there? I know you tell a great story about when you were given your salary as an associate, you had a interesting response to that.
Yeah, so we were given an offer, all of us graduating. I think there were six of us that were graduating at the time. And we were given an offer to come on as associates. And, the issue, and this is that firm that I worked at it was every other firm acting the exact same way, right? You treated everyone equally to a fault. And maybe firms, some of the big firms maybe still do that with respect to the way they pay and do other things. And so we all got the same offers, and I wasn't happy with that. And so I didn't accept it. They eventually, after they spoke with the partners that we all worked for, came back and they gave me $5,000 more, distinguished me. I accepted the offer. And then the next day they gave the other five $5,000 more. And it was shortly after that that I gave Paul a call and said, what do you think about starting our own firm?
And I guess, what do you think gave you that initial confidence to even ask for a different salary at the time? You spent a year there?
And I had been there less than a year. Okay. You know, I was, as a patent examiner, I was really good at the job. I mean, I really could do the job a full, 130% production in a few hours a day. And I had no idea what it was going to be like as an attorney, law clerk at the time. And it wasn't that difficult for me. And so I figured that, at that time of my life, I'm single, no families, Paul or me, what's the worst thing that can happen from starting a firm? We fail, and then we go back to firms, or we go in-house or do something different.
It was also around, so this was late 90s.
Late 90s.
It was also around the time of a dot-com boom. Did that inspire your thinking? You're hearing about all these companies,
It did. And, that was one of probably the bigger surprises for me when we started up the firm, was that there just wasn't enough patent attorneys in 1999 and 2000 to do all of the work. So we would get phone calls. I mean, we did zero business development. We'd sit at our desk, phone would ring. We got calls from AMD. We got calls from Google. We got calls from Juniper Networks. Are you interested in doing patent work for us? Yes. And that was as far as the business development went. So we were very fortunate when we started the firm.
I guess before you started it, did you have any concerns about, I don't have enough experience, or I haven't been in the field this long, that I don't know the in-house counsel at all these companies?
No, I wasn't worried about anything to do with experience. We know a lot of people. I knew a lot of people at my previous firm. Paul knew a lot of people at Finnegan and at other firms. And so I knew that we would have people that we could bounce ideas off of or ask questions of and get some examples of anything that we were going to be doing.
Yeah.
I mean, doing patent preparation and prosecution are difficult tasks, but they're not that difficult. I kind of had it down, and he had it down at Finnegan. So I wasn't that worried about doing the day-to-day work.
What about the business development aspect? Before you started and you were getting these calls, did you have something in mind? Like, I need to make sure we're going to have some work coming in, or you kind of said, let's take the leap and, we'll figure it out.
It was absolutely, let's take the leap and let's see what happens. And I can tell you, we were so fortunate starting off. So when Paul was working at Finnegan, they were lending him out to GTE to work in-house. Yeah. And we were pretty confident that we could get GTE work until we asked for the GTE work. and the in-house attorney wanted to get us on the list.
Right.
But he went to the chief patent counsel, and the chief patent counsel says, no. We only have the top firms representing us. And so he said no. And he went back to us and told us no. And then Finnegan stepped in, and Finnegan said, we'll give you a dozen cases, GTE cases, to draft.
Yeah.
And the in-house attorney went to the chief patent counsel and said, they're doing our work. Why don't we just give it to them directly? And he said, go ahead and do it. And, fast forward, now we've represented them for 20 years.
So. That's a great story.
Yeah. Finnegan was amazing to do something like that. I mean, really, outside of our firm, even though I've never worked at Finnegan, my second favorite firm by far.
So I guess while that was going on, while you were, waiting for Finnegan to step in and all that, any concerns, any worries at that point, or you kind of knew it would come into place?
I knew that it would come. We all had some savings, and so we could go for some period of time. Yeah. But literally, it was possibly within the first week, and it might have been even in the first couple of days that Finnegan handed us 12 cases to draft.
Okay.
And so I wasn't, and then things started rolling with the phone started ringing and it wasn't a concern.
That's great. You also always hear there's a saying, never mix family and business. But not only did you start with your brother, but you started with your twin brother.
Yeah.
Did you ever think about that? Or I guess, how did you?
So had no idea how we were going to do. So growing up, we weren't the type of twins that were hanging out with each other. We had our own separate friends. We went our own separate ways. After college, he went to Texas. I came down here to Northern Virginia. We both then ended up at the patent office. But as soon as I joined the art unit he was in, and the day I joined, he left along with the supervisor of that art unit and went to a different art unit.
Yeah.
So we didn't work together. I had no idea whether we would be butting heads or not, and really have been on the same page since day one, which is surprising to me.
Yeah. Well, that's great. What advice would you give to somebody else, I guess, in your situation to figure out, would they be able to be in a business with their sibling or family member?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, it's personalities, and maybe before you even get started, you know, Paul and I were on the same page as to what was going to distinguish us, what was going to be kind of our core value here. And so if you can get that worked out and you both stick with that, then you should be fine.
Yeah.
If you can't come to an agreement, I wouldn't even take the next step of going into business together.
Right. And I remember when I joined, the two things that were stressed were second attorney review, which I'm imagining you guys got from Finnegan, and uniform writing style. Were those things that you had in place and thought about before you started the firm, or was it kind of organically you came to the conclusion that those are important?
Yeah, so we had the conversation before, you know, it, when we both came to an agreement that we were going to do this and start this firm. You know, we started with the foundational question. It's a question that anybody that comes and asks me about doing business development and how do you do it, I always ask the exact same question. Why you? Why should anyone give you work? And so that's really where we started. We said, okay, there's thousands of patent firms doing prep and pros in the electrical mechanical areas. Why would anyone give us work? And what we came down to is we said, quality is going to be our thing. You know, so if we take care of quality, then everything else will take care of itself. And that's really the way that it's played out. And so when you talk about quality, right, quality is a subjective thing. That's a tough thing to measure. So the expectation that we came up with, we said, look, we'll spend as much time internally here at the firm until we get to this expected level of quality. So what, you know, what does that mean? What that means to us is when we send this work out to inventors, in-house counsel, whoever's going to look at it, we want to get a looks good. We want to give them something that we determine, that we looked at and think is in ready to be filed form, send it to them, you know, decrease the time that they have to spend with, you know, our work, let them spend it with other firms' work. And so that's what we'll do. And we'll spend, and we've, everything that we've done from the beginning of the firm has been with a focus on quality. And yes, second attorney review is part of that, a very thorough review, as you know. Uniform writing style, uniform process, really. It's even more than just the style of writing. It's the steps that we take. It's all about getting to that expectation. We're 20 years in, and it's still the driving factor of everything that we do.
In the beginning, did you have a long-term vision about what the firm would look like? And I mean, in terms of, did you think you would be doing the work yourself, you know, you and your brother, or did you have a vision, you know, you'd become, you know,
Finnegan,
the 25-person firm or Finnegan?
Had no vision whatsoever. You know, so Paul and I had never run a business. We had never managed people. And in our early days, we worked based on our gut, what feels right, ridiculously, you know, striving for excellence. We were so anal about every single thing because, again, it's kind of this quality. If we give them quality, they'll come back. And where we thought we would go, no idea. I mean, really the turning point, one of the turning points for us here at this firm was around 2006 when Paul and I started reading some books about running businesses because even at 2000, you know, we're 7 years into this and we still have no concept of what we're doing. And so we started reading a ton of books and we come up with a vision. And, you know what our mission is here at this firm. And so that mission kind of started 2006, 2007, after we've read many, many, many books on, you know, running a business. And the conclusion that we came to in 2008 is we have this vision of where we want to go. And the people that we have on our bus are not the right people to get us there. I mean, we're moving in one direction and half the firm is moving in the complete opposite direction. So 2008, we had to pivot. That was one of the big pivots at the firm. Yeah. And we took a small step backwards to take huge strides forward.
Yeah. I guess I have two questions. One is, so, you know, it seemed like in the beginning it was very easy for you, you know, getting work, you know, and I'm guessing you were doing as well as you could have imagined at that point. But what I guess prompted you to, you know, start reading business books and, you know, trying to learn more about what you could be doing differently?
Yeah, you know, the work did kind of come easy for us because there weren't enough patent attorneys. So the phone would ring quite often. And even though, you know, in our early days, we really operated as a black box to all of our clients. They didn't know we had a second attorney review. They probably figured out that we have a uniform writing style because they got the same look from every single attorney.
Yeah.
What prompted us to start reading books? It was one of the attorneys that we had at the firm who was partner, and he stepped down from partner. And a light bulb went off for me and for Paul at the same time. Like, I'm not thinking about the future at all. Yeah. I'm living in the now. And as soon as this person steps down and they're talking about, you know, retirement or getting out of the field, and I start saying, well, what's my retirement plan? Like, what are we doing here? And then the conversation started and the book reading started very, very soon, probably within a month of that person stepping down from partner.
Interesting how that turned into something great. I guess you talked about how in the beginning you were obviously obsessed with quality, but then you did hire other associates and other attorneys. How difficult was it to trust somebody else to, you know, do the work? I guess, obviously, you're going to review it, but how difficult is it to trust them, you know, what they do is going to be good enough as a final product?
Well, the only way that you can, right? So you're hiring people based on a pulse, and they come in, and it's a complete wild card as to whether this person's going to be an A player or a D or F player. And so Paul and I would review everything. We would train the people, and we would review every single thing that leaves the firm. And we'll review it as many times as we have to review it so that we can ensure that it's ready to go and we increase those chances of getting that looks good. Yeah. So we were the stopgap. Yeah. That's the way we would filter it. And those people who we had to look at work 2, 3, 4, 5 times every single time, they're just not going to make it and they would be weeded out eventually.
It's funny because I do run into attorneys who have a 1 or 2 person firm. They had it for the last 20 or 30 years, and they say, well, my clients want to send me more work, but I just can't. they're just not, you know, they can't for some reason mentally either take on that responsibility of training somebody or really trusting anybody else but themselves. So it is a problem that I...
Yeah, I don't have that problem with trusting other people. As long as the work, you know, everyone can have a bad day, right? That's why our second attorney review is so important, because your bad day doesn't get out the door. The reviewer is going to stop it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll never grow if you don't get over the fact that you're going to need to train someone else and trust them to be able to do something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And were there any difficulties in the beginning of the firm in terms of, you know, it seems like the training, the hiring was a difficult part, but the business development was easy. Did anything keep you up at night, I guess, in the beginning?
Nothing necessarily kept me up at night, but it was very difficult in the early days just not knowing what we're doing. You know, we're not really good financially. We're having to trust the bookkeepers back then. We don't have an accountant. Couldn't afford an accountant. And not really knowing what we're doing was probably the thing that, if anything stressed me out, that would be the thing. Like, yeah, here's another attorney that we've hired who's failing. I'm having to look at things five times, and we have to get rid of this one and get another one and hope that the next one is going to be good enough to be able to make it.
So I guess I want to discuss some of the features of the firm, and this is a conversation me and you and had before, but talk about some of the features of the firm that I think kind of make it different from other firms, and I want to get your sense of if you think that's contributed to the success of the firm or not. So the first feature is that our firm focuses mostly, almost solely on patent preparation prosecution. So we don't do litigation, we don't do other types of
licensing
work. How much do you think that's contributed to, I guess, the success of the firm?
I think it's been a huge part of the success of the firm. You know, we're not distracted with the other things, right? When you're working at a firm and you're trying to juggle litigation, patent preparation, and patent prosecution, we all know what the order of things are, right? Litigation comes first.
Yeah.
Then prosecution comes second. Why? Because there's PTO deadlines and fees are going to be involved with extensions if you don't hit the deadlines. And then whenever you get around to it, you'll work on a patent application.
Yeah.
And so what happens? These patent applications drag on forever. If you want to be number one with clients, you can't have these patent applications dragging on forever and them having to ping you regularly.
That makes sense. And is that something you had in mind from the very beginning that you're just going to focus on that? Or did you ever think, well, we'll just take whatever work comes and we'll go?
You know, it wasn't a conscious decision, but it was absolutely our focus that we were going to do patent preparation and prosecution and not do licensing and not do litigation. And mainly it's because we didn't have an interest in doing those two things and didn't really have the experience doing either one of them either.
So another feature of our firm is that most of our clients are large, mostly US-based, but large technology companies that file a lot of patents. What kind of role do you think that has played in the firm?
It's been a huge part of the firm's success again. I mean, when you think about it from a business perspective, right? So if there was a time, if we didn't have these large filing patent 300 clients, and there was a time where we ran light on work, where do we go to get work, right? These large institutional clients that file a ton, there's unlimited work, almost unlimited work from these sources. So you can go over to the spigots and you can fill it up with as much work as you want when you're number one with clients. So that is a big part. And the other part that, you know, anybody who's represented solo inventors and startups and those types of things, which we did in the early days, we didn't discriminate as to who we would represent. We do today. We didn't then. You know, there's going to be times where bills aren't going to get paid.
Right.
Our collections are 100%. And our clients are outstanding at paying very timely.
Yeah.
And I thought that was normal in our field. But when I talk to partners at other firms, they say it's unheard of.
Yeah. When I talk to partners at other firms, they tell me a big part of their job is actually doing the collections.
Yeah. No, not for us.
So another feature, and I think that ties into that, is the fact that we do almost all fixed fee work. First, how did that come about? And then, obviously, what kind of role do you think that has played in the success of the firm?
Again, where we are today, that's a very important part of our journey. So we started doing fixed fee work with GTE back in 1999.
Interesting.
So for all of our large clients over the years, it's always been fixed fee work. We did have some hourly things for smaller clients in the early days. You know what the tendency is, right? I mean, especially today. I mean, the patent 300 companies, cost conscious, right? I mean, their dollar value is very important. And at the lower price point, they want high quality and they want it timely. And they should. That's the reality. They should demand that even at a lower price point. The struggle outside of this firm, when you have, you know, the old school pay structure of lockstep and ever increasing salaries, which means ever increasing hourly rates, is a huge struggle to get people at the high, you know, fourth, fifth year associates and on to do work at low price points because their hourly rates are just absolutely through the roof.
Yeah.
And it makes it almost impossible. So for us, you know, with fixed fees, we focus on efficiencies. And we know what it is. We know what quality needs to go out the door. We know when it needs to go out the door. And for us, it's a simple formula. Once you understand and think of it from a business perspective, you can't think of it from the old school law firm model perspective. That's right. That's a flawed model.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work in today's environment. So it's very important to us. I like fixed fees. Tell me the price and we'll put the process in place, lean process in place to get there and make it profitable for us, a win for you, us and a win for you.
And it seems GTE was really ahead of its time in terms of fixed fee. I don't know if that was the case, but you hear a lot, you know, at least I read all the time, you know, clients are demanding fixed fees, you know, they want a predictability and all that. And then it kind of goes away and it never kind of gets implemented in other areas. It seems like it's much more prevalent in our patent preparation prosecution. I guess, do you have any guesses about why it's been so difficult, I guess, for the legal industry and the clients to kind of demand and adapt to that?
Outside of patent preparation prosecution? Yeah, you know, I don't know the other areas as well, right? Yeah. So my guess would be that it isn't as predictable. You know, it's with the tasks that we do, right? They're fixed tasks. They're repeatable. The steps can be very repeatable, which most attorneys don't understand that, you know, the steps to prepare a response, the steps to draft a patent application, if you repeat them and do them exactly the same every time, you're going to get really, really efficient at doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, order of those steps are important too. And sometimes people don't understand that. Outside of this area, I don't know, like with a litigation, I know fixed fee is getting to be more popular, but I don't know if that's as easy to adapt as it is to what we do. I mean, it's very similar to the patent office model, right? I mean, you have to prepare office actions and you have a certain amount of time to do it.
Yeah.
And you just work within those guidelines and we do the exact same thing.
Yeah, I think you kind of hinted at it, but the last feature that I want to discuss that I think it makes our firm different is really the compensation structure. Here, the attorneys are compensated on a production basis instead of, you know, a fixed salary and, you know, some undefined bonus at the end. First of all, how did you come up with that structure? How did you get an idea for that structure? And I guess, what kind of role do you think that has played?
You know, so at the time, you know, the experience that I had at my previous firm and Paul had at his previous firm and where my friends were at other firms, they were all lockstop models. And that wasn't something that we knew from the very beginning, that wasn't the right structure to run a business because you're not incentivizing people who want to work harder. And so we wanted to have an arrangement where if people want to work hard, I don't care if you're a first-year associate or a seventh-year associate. The first-year associate, if he's going to work twice as hard as the seventh year, he should make more money. He's working harder.
Yeah.
And so it was just, to me, having the conversations, and Paul did too before we started the firm, as to this pay, this you know, fixed-scale model that the other firms have. It just isn't the right thing. And for us, it's you know, paying for performance, right? What does that lead to? How do you, when you have a fixed salary at whatever firm, and you know, many of them still have that exact same model, right? How do I incentivize you to draft 100 patent applications? I can't. You're not getting paid anymore to do that, right? Your requirement might be 50, 30, and I want to get you to incentivize you to draft 100. How would I possibly do that unless I'm going to pay you for performance?
Right.
And so it seemed to me like, and right from the, even before we opened the doors, that had to be the model that we were going to go with.
And have you run into any downsides with a just production-based model? And I guess, how do you navigate those?
So yeah, the one thing that really, really surprised me. So Paul and I have the same work ethic. You know, when you have basically an eat what you kill model, I always thought people would kill a lot and eat a lot. I just thought that's what everyone would do because that's what I would do.
Right.
And so we hire people based on a pulse and many come in and they're barely doing anything. I mean, for an entire year, they're not you know, they're not making a lot, but they're not producing a lot. And we have a lot of work that we have to get done.
Right.
And so it's requiring us to hire more people and try to incentivize them and to do more. And the end of the day is what I've found out over the years is that there's a lot of people that just money isn't a driving factor. I thought it was for most people. It isn't.
Yeah.
And that's just the realization. And so that was a big struggle with that model. I really expected people to really blow it out. And to just put things into perspective, we have attorneys now that are billing more, significantly more in the first quarter of the year than what attorneys back in our early days were billing in an entire year.
Yeah, wow.
Significantly more than what they were doing the whole year. So big difference.
So it seems finding the right people is really the key to
people are everything. Absolutely right.
So obviously we started this conversation with talking about innovation, and I guess you talked about how that came about, that you had a client come to you and say, you know, we're going to lower our fees. And I guess you realize we need to become more efficient, but I guess, you know, where did you go from there? You know,
what do we do? Yeah. That's the big question, right? Because, everyone can say we should be more efficient. And I'm sure there's many firms out there right now that are saying, we just need to get more efficient at what we do and that we can make this profitable. You know, I'll go back to one of the things that I said before. Reading books is one of those. You know, I read a ton of books. It's amazing to me when I spill the beans on the main thing that's been the success of this firm, reading books, and I'll pass that on to other people who will ask me advice about running a firm, and they say, I don't have enough time.
Right.
And I say, well, you do. You know, I carry a book with me everywhere I go. If I'm sitting waiting at a doctor's office for an appointment, I'll read. I listen to a book in the car. So reading really is an important part of, you know, of getting us where we were supposed to go, and with focusing on efficiencies was reading a ton of books. And, you know, the main where we started with respect to efficiencies was where all the price drops were happening, and that was with the drafting side.
Yeah.
So at that time, you were here at the time, you know that every one of our attorneys were saying, the only way you can make money at Herity & Herity is on the prosecution team. You can't be a top biller on the drafting team.
Yeah.
And as you know, as we fast forward here to last year, top three billers were drafters.
Right.
And so we've come a long ways. And let me put it in perspective with, you know, I'm not going to go through all the techniques and share them with everybody what we've done, but let me put in some numbers to kind of put it in perspective, right? In 2012, before we started our efficiency journey, we drafted 237 patent applications. The top drafter drafted 54 patent applications, and the second highest was 42. Last year, we drafted 812 patent applications. We had four attorneys draft more than 90 patent applications and one at 88. And then one more is the beginning of this year. We have an attorney, you may not know, that, you know, we're only a quarter of the year, a third of the year into the year, but he's on pace to draft 160 patent applications.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what we've done.
So I know you don't want to go into all of the details, but I guess can you give us a little sense of like, how did you identify, you know, what's causing, you know, somebody to draft a patent application slowly? And then how did you kind of figure out what would the solution to that be? You know, obviously you're reading books about business that have nothing to do with specifically efficiency in patent prosecution. So I guess.
I have read books about lean manufacturing.
Yeah.
So it's the same steps, right? Take a look at every single step of the process and which of those steps have to be performed by an attorney and which don't. And any of the ones that don't have to be performed by an attorney, I don't want an attorney wasting time on.
Right.
So there's certain things that obviously, on it, we'll talk about drafting as an example, right, that an attorney has to do. They have to conduct the interview with the inventor. I can't hand that off to a support staff member, right? But they don't have to send out formal documents and follow up with inventors to get formal documents executed. And then part of what we do, so we lean the process out. We arrange the steps in the most efficient way, and then we automate things. As you know, we've automated steps of the process that we can automate. And so that's helped us get the numbers significantly down.
that makes sense. I think you mentioned that other people come to you for advice about how to better run their business, and you say you read books. And I'm sure some other managing partners might be listening to this, or partners at other firms, and they said, okay, I'll read the books, I'll find some time for that, but then, you know, how will I ever find time to manage those projects and make sure they're implemented correctly? You know, I have to do the legal work. Can you give a little sense about your day? You know, how much of your day is devoted to innovation, and how do you kind of structure your schedule to make sure that, you know, the firm is moving forward?
Look, read the books. Read things that, you know, Warren Buffett or Bill Gates talks about, and there should be think time. And I know I need to be spending more time thinking about that. So with respect to my day, I'm probably doing billable tasks half of the day, and then managing the firm a quarter of the day, and then innovation is probably the last quarter of my days.
And that's still pretty significant, I'm guessing, to what the average law firm partner spends on that. I guess a part of our innovation and how we're different is that, you know, you mentioned that some of the automation that we do, we actually have our own software development team. We actually also have our own analytics team. We have a head of each one of those teams. How did you make the decision, and was it kind of a leap that, you know, this is something that we should invest in instead of, you know, taking tiny steps, you know, hiring some outside vendor and seeing what they do? How did you come to the decision that, you know, we really need those capabilities, bring them in-house to our firm?
Well, we did, you know, again, from a business perspective, the first inclination isn't to do these things internal. I would love to have hired externally to do this, where I don't have to hire employees internally to do the tasks. But with a lot of things that are out on the market, this is just the way that it is. When you do patent preparation and prosecution for a living, and, you know, I've done it for, over 25 years, I've been in this field, you know what, you know, you can evaluate these products that are for whatever they are to help us draft more quickly, review patent applications, analytics tools that are out on the market, software tools that are out on the market to help us do various things. And you quickly understand, they're, even though they pretend to have been developed by people who say they do this for a living, they're not. And the end result is it forces us to have to develop it ourselves, really for ourselves, but we know if it's for us, it's going to also help others eventually. So with patent analytics, you know, this was something, this is just the way it is today with the Patent 300. Cost conscious, as I've talked about. Yep. High quality at that lower price. Yep. Timeliness. Yep. Extra value for free. Yeah. You got to do that too. I mean, we're not in the business of nickel and diming anybody for anything, as any of our clients know. And so it started off that we get access to the data. We hired some outside people to get us access to the data. We collect, you know, more than a decade's worth of patent data, and then we start analyzing, and then we start providing for free to our clients. And what we find out is most often our clients don't even know about themselves. So basic things. To me, I look at reports today and I say, isn't this basic? But it really isn't to others, because I've been looking at it now for 5 or 6 years of looking at stats like this, which seem basic, but they're not, because people don't know it. Law firms don't know about themselves. They don't know, or companies, the Patent 300 don't know about themselves. Law firms probably don't either, actually. No. They don't know about their law firms. They don't know about their competition, where they're filing, where we're not filing, where we're filing, where they're not filing, you know, white space analysis. And so we started basic. Let's just collect some stats about us. Let's collect some stats about our clients. Let's provide those to the clients so they know how we're doing, how they're doing, what they're, you know, even their office action to allowance rates overall, and those types of stats, prosecution related stats and quantities.
Well, let's say you're a trademark lawyer or a trademark lawyer who's a partner at a firm, and you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, there's a lot of things that I can automate. There's a lot of ways that my clients might want to use analytics. But at what point would you recommend, you know, deciding, you know, should I be just hire somebody and see if they can figure it out? Should I, you know, start talking to, you know, all these vendors that are out there? you know, how do you balance the two? Because, you know, if you went through this journey, and I don't know if part of that journey was a waste of time trying out with these other vendors, I guess, how do you balance all that?
Well, I would absolutely say, well, number one, you've got to be all in. If this is what you're going to do and get involved with kind of this type of patent analytics and and software automation, you really got to go all in on it. And, you know, I would absolutely, as a starting point, even today going through the whole process, if we were starting over, I'd still analyze everything that's out on the market. I don't want to recreate the wheel. If something's out there that's good enough for us, I would absolutely use it. And we do. There's some products that we do pay for. Claim Master is one of those that checks every one of our patent applications. Every single response is run through Claim Master to, you know, looking for those things. We know what Claim Master and Patent Optimizer, same tools. So if there's somebody that's doing it and they're doing it well, hey, it's easier to do that than to develop. It took us, I mean, it takes us a long time to find these A players. For our software development manager, it took a year of looking and to find this person. Law degree, patent office experience. He was an examiner. I mean, it was once we found him, like, yeah, this is the guy. We don't have to explain any basics about what a computer readable medium claim is or anything like that. He knows it already. So we could just start speaking the same language immediately.
And I'm sure we've had so many different projects, so many different ways to innovate. Is there anything that sticks out to you that, I guess, didn't work out? And then I guess just to broaden that, how do you measure if something was a worthwhile investment? And, you know, how do you learn from that, I guess, going forward?
Yeah, so anytime that we implement something new, we try something new. Now, look, I come up with ideas. Probably more than half of the ideas are horrendous ideas. And sometimes some of them stop at the idea stage. I throw it out to some people and they're like, yeah, that's a terrible idea. And they'll say something to tell me and I'm like, yeah, okay, let me go back and figure out something else. But I'll hit on some too. Yeah. And so we never just implement something. I mean, that's a horrendous business decision to just throw it out at everybody. So what we do, and we're currently running a pilot on our drafting team with, we started the year with one attorney, then we'll roll it out. But we don't just push things out. You've got to test it. And let me tell you, there's many things, including things that we even moved forward implementing that turned out to be failures. And, you know, failures, we shouldn't be afraid of failing on things, right? Yeah. We learn from them. We learn and you get better. I mean, you know, we celebrated the biggest, there was a huge failure last year by one of our support staff members that discovered a flaw in our backup system that we were able to correct because he made a mistake. Fantastic. It made the firm better. That's what we should be doing. So yeah, we want to fail, but we want to fail fast.
So I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sensing that the key to innovation and really it helping your legal practice is trying all these things. If you're not willing to kind of experiment and fail, like you said, then it's really not.
Don't go down the, if you're afraid of that, then don't even go down the journey. Yeah, it's not worth it.
All right. So I guess before we get to the end, I wanted to ask some advice. So obviously we've talked about a lot of advice about innovation, but let's say you're talking to a young John Harity at a big law firm who's trying to figure out his career. And he's thinking about maybe starting his own law firm. What advice would you give him in this legal market? You know, whether it's a worthwhile journey, if he's the person to kind of do it, and, you know, how he should prepare himself.
Yeah. This is a tougher legal market than when I started, when we started this firm. So today, you know, I've said it over and over, right? We're in a very, very competitive landscape where companies, especially the big filers, are cost conscious. They want high quality. And so you need to understand that you want to, again, you don't want to model yourself after the old, you know, 1960s law firm model, business model. That's a flawed model. You want to operate yourself as a business. So anybody who would be interested in starting, I would give them a list of books and I'd tell them to read these books and then have some discussions to make sure they understand what they're getting into and making sure that, do you understand that there might be today it isn't, your phone's not going to ring for you from Google and everybody else. So can you go some period of time without work? Let's develop your brand. Let's develop your pitch. Be able to answer the question, why you? That's the thing. If you can't answer that question, and most existing firms can't answer that question, then really you're not competing with us if you can't answer a simple question like that. And you really probably shouldn't be competing in the space. You maybe should stay at a firm.
And I guess obviously reading the books is an important part of it, but probably saving up money because you're not going to be getting clients immediately. But is there any other advice that you would give about, like, I guess, preparing yourself in terms of, you know, is it really bad developing those relationships that might lead to work? Is it learning certain skills while you're at that law firm? Or is it, you know, there is no perfect time in terms of making that leap? And it's kind of, if you're actually thinking about it and you're serious about it, you kind of have to go for it.
So, yeah, developing, you know, your network of people, staying in contact constantly with your network of people, absolutely important, right? You never know who's going to go in-house. But, you know, even with your friend going to a key position at a key company, that still doesn't mean success for you. It might get you to the dance, but now you have to perform. So you really, you know, if you're going in this wanting to work 1,200 hours a year, I don't know that you should really do it. You have to be willing to put in whatever amount of time is necessary. I mean, that was... Paul and I were like that from the very beginning. If it required me, and it did from time to time, working 7 days a week, 15, 16, 18-hour days, we do whatever is necessary to make sure that the quality and the timeliness is being hit. If you don't have that mentality, you know, maybe you could be successful, get lucky, but I'd probably tell you, think about doing something different.
Yeah. And I guess now you have a different vantage point as a managing partner. You have 25 attorneys. I guess let's say you're an associate at our firm or a similar situated firm, and you're trying to figure out, well, how do I add value to a firm in a way that matters? You know, what advice would you give to an associate like that?
I would tell the individual, number one, to read the book Winning by Jack Welch. That's going to give you all the keys to how you're going to succeed and impress your bosses. And it's going above and beyond expectations. You know, if you really want to impress, you've got to put in a full court effort. You've got to exceed expectations every single time, which means hitting every deadline. It doesn't necessarily mean, which some people think, it doesn't necessarily mean saying yes to everything that comes to your door. You can say no to things. That's fine. But when you say yes, 100% of the time, you should be exceeding expectations. So that's not handing it in when the partner wants it. It's handing it in before the partner wants it. And it's been thoroughly looked at by you in really this, you know, same expectation we talk about here, ready to be filed form.
And I guess the final advice is maybe to a new in-house counsel or a new maybe chief patent counsel who's, you know, taking over some portfolio. They have existing law firms. I guess, what advice would you give them about kind of evaluating their existing law firms, managing those existing law firms, finding new law firms? You know, what advice would you go process? And obviously, we're talking about patent preparation and prosecution.
Yeah. You know, the number one thing I would say to in-house counsels, don't settle. You know, a lot of times, right, we're engineers. We were the nerds in school, right? And which, you know, comes with a lot of things. We're awkward as engineers and you know, typically we're good at the math and the science. We're not good at the English part of things. And so we don't write well or communicate. We're awkward with people and all those types of things. So one thing that's really prevalent that I've seen over the years from people that we've hired and from in-house counsel and attorneys at other firms, a fear of change. So it's easy to get into a position, and I've heard in-house counsel say, I dislike all of my firms. Well, why aren't you firing them? Well, I know them, and that's the reason that I'm sticking with them. And I'd say don't settle. Don't settle. Expect whatever price point you're using with respect to your patent work, expect excellence. Expect high quality. Expect it to be timely. and expect it to be done by people with experience, right? I hear this from in-house counsel all the time, that the law firm is saying, well, look, at this price point, I have to give the work down to the bottom. I have to have a technical writer work it on it at this price point, and we can't review it at this price point. Then you don't care about quality. The law firm doesn't care, and really you should move on. There are firms, there are a lot of great firms out there that care about customer service. And when I talk about customer service, I'm talking about the quality aspect. I'm talking about the timeliness aspect of it. And I would tell you, move on. At the price point that you want, you will get outstanding firms to do the work, U.S. firms, to produce the quality and do the timeliness.
Well, how do you find out if your firms are any good or not?
So today, it's not that difficult, right? So even if you don't track anything internally, if you track stuff internally, you know, for most part, probably, you know, some things about your firms. You know, I feel like if you're not tracking the stats and you're not obtaining stats from some patent analytics source, then what you're doing is you have a gut feel based on the quality of the work. And you know the way it is at firms, right? You might like the quality of one attorney's work, you might not like the other. That's a difference here, right?
Yeah.
We have the uniformity, we don't have that. But get some patent analytics. I mean, it's out there in a lot of different sources. And the things I would be looking for is, do these firms, are they really true partners of mine? Do they care about my portfolio? Do they care about my money? And Eli, you know, I don't like to spend my own money, and I hate clients wasting money more than I hate wasting my own money. And so you can get the stats. How many claims are they filing? Are they just randomly filing claims? We had a comment made from somebody, I think it was a prospective attorney who was looking to join us, who looked at some stuff and said, you know, all of your patent applications have, or the patents are 20 total claims and 3 independents. That's really interesting. And this was an in-house person applying for a job here. Yeah, right. If we cancel claims, the clients paid for 20 and 3, add them back in. You
right.
know that. It's just
yeah.
routine for you now, right? And that's just the way we think. But when we get cases transferred in, it doesn't happen that way. We'll see cases with 34 claims with 10 independents, and they all look, they're the same statutory class, and they all look exactly the same. It's like, what a waste of money that's happened here. So you can tell, you can get some stats that talk about claim counts. You can get stats that talk about extensions of time. You know, from an in-house person's perspective, is it our fault of these extensions, or is it the outside counsel's fault? And if it's the outside counsel's fault, I'm usually alarmed, right? You know the way I feel about extensions of time here, right? It sends one of two signals to clients. It tells them, hey, you're sending us too much, send us less. We don't want to send, any firm doesn't want to send that message. Or we prioritize client A's work over yours. So whenever we get to yours, and that's why we have to take extensions on yours, because we can't get to it. Those are horrendous signals to send, especially if you want to be number one with the client.
Yeah.
So pay attention to those things. And they can easily get stats from a lot of different sources to understand how their firms are doing, and feel free to trim. I mean, that's the thing. And you can, with stats too, you can, any new firm that approaches you, get the same type of stats for the companies that they represent and see how they're doing
right.
before you bring them on. I mean, yeah. this isn't rocket science, but the data is available today.
And I guess let's say you figure out which your outside counsel is good, you keep those, or you find new great outside counsel. I mean, what advice would you give about managing them? Do you see any mistakes that, I guess, outside counsel do in terms of how they devote their time and resources?
You know, when you have good firms, right, it should be minimal time on in-house counsel's perspective having to manage them. So the ideal situation is very light touches. I don't, you know, in an ideal situation, right, when you have the right firms, I don't have to send reminders for my firms to do their work. I should never have to do that. I shouldn't have to correct mistakes that they're making, especially blatant ones. I shouldn't have to train their attorneys in how to draft patent applications or responses. So in an ideal situation with the right firms, these are all light touches. Your job, you know, our job from the outside counsel is to make their job really easy.
Yeah.
And so with some of our clients, as you know, they don't even look at our work because they know we do a very thorough review internally.
Yeah.
So get firms to commit to doing the right things, and it makes, boy, it makes your job so much easier. Now you can do the other stuff that pulling you away from the managing of outside counsel and reviewing work.
That makes sense. So two final questions, hopefully fun ones.
Okay.
So the first one is, if you didn't end up following your path, is there any other career path that you would have wanted to follow?
You know, so that's an interesting question. So I'm innovative. So I think that I probably would have started a business. Now, what would that business be? I really have no idea. So I probably would have started something, and probably my path would have been similar running a business. It just wouldn't be in this patent space. So, but I don't have any idea what it would have ended up in.
And you talked about that partner who retired from a firm a long time ago and that got you to start thinking about the future and what you might do in your retirement. Do you have any kind of, I guess, dreams of something else you might do after this
after
firm or,
this.
Yeah, or anything like that?
I'm going to probably 10 years before I retire, I will start planning. You know, the problem that people have that retire who don't plan,
yeah,
right, is that what I envision is I love to work out. So I would say, well, I'm just going to spend more time working out. So here's what would happen if I don't plan it out. I retire. I get up at 5. Let's say I lift for an hour and I'm going to do cardio for another hour. Now it's 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And what am I doing with the rest of my day? I'm just sitting in my basement or wherever, and I don't know what I'm doing. So I will plan, fully plan out. So my game plan is to do more charity work. We've started, as you already know, doing some charity work. My wife and I have a support group at Fairfax Hospital that we started after I had my heart attack. And I fully expect that I'll be way more engaged in charity work as I get closer to retirement, and that'll be an easy transition. And maybe, for all I know, we'll spin Herity for Charity off and do its own thing, and I'll work full-time doing that.
That's great. It was great talking to you on this podcast. Thank you so much for doing this.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Eli.